Welcome all.
Yeah, we can talk about it. Oh my God, I'm meeting.
Got my favorite nurses here too.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
We're calling the meeting to order. Welcome. Shall we start with introductions and start with Dr. Zendel?
Dr. Les Zendel, I am a member of this committee and president of the healthcare.
Stephen Hike, accounting manager for Desert Healthcare District.
Chris Christensen, interim CEO of Desert Healthcare District.
Andrea Hale, special assistant to the CEO, board relations manager at Desert Healthcare District.
Yeah, Peter Richardson, I'm the president of the Desert Regional Medical Center, also.
Ezra Kaufman, Desert Regional. Desert Healthcare District resident.
We call you adopted Desert Regional.
Two ladies in the
back. Yeah, she's the last.
I'm Kathy Moreno, I work at Desert Regional, nice to you.
Lori Ruggiero, I'm here at the Desert Regional, nice to you. Laura Bruce, I work at Desert, Palm Springs, resident.
Mitch Blumberg, chairman of the governing board at Desert Regional Medical Center.
Michelle Finney, CEO of Desert.
Christine Lang, Walter, chief quality officer at Desert.
Thank you, and Carol Rogers, vice president of the healthcare district, and I got my new badge. Even though I'm retired, I am an RN. You never retire, do you, right?
That's nice.
Thank you. I need approval of the agenda.
I move the agenda be approved.
Second. Motion carried. At this time, we have time for public comments to our friends. Oh, Stephanie Salter, I'm introducing you, patient advocate, and Desert Healthcare District resident. Anybody here have a public comment?
Yeah, I have a public comment. I saw that in the annual audit of the healthcare district, the outside auditor estimated that.
I'm sorry, are you talking about financial?
Yeah.
Okay, that's not a.
No, this is where I got the initial information from.
Oh, okay.
To ask this question, that it would take probably about $72 million to run the hospital should the current lessee either be forced to abdicate its current lease or choose to abdicate its current lease. Now, the district has on hand, unencumbered, about $35 million. Is there a plan to run the hospital in that kind of contingency, whether we have the money or not? Is there a list of the contractors who work at the hospital?
We haven't addressed that yet. So when we do, we will make that public.
Well, I think that's something that Chris can address in writing and...
Are we going to respond to?
Yeah.
Well, considering that there are board minutes that go back more than 15 years that address the exact same question, you would think that this would be one of those, you know, existential things that the board would have.
And it's appropriate for you to get an answer from the board.
And what kind of time frame is that answer going to come in?
But we'll address your question and get it responded to.
No, I've been asked about a time frame. I expect a response,
Would 30 days, say, be sufficient?
Sure.
Within 30 days. Thank you so very much.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else? Hearing none, we'll move on. Need approval of the minutes of September 20th meeting.
I move the minutes be approved.
I second. Motion carried. Is there any old business?
I'm sorry, Michelle, I didn't say anything to you beforehand, but since it was brought up at the last meeting about the spider crawling on a baby in the NICU, and you did address it to us, could you respond for the minutes, please?
I am trying to remember exactly what the outcome was. I mean, did verify that the facility is on regular vector control process. We have a contract in place. I believe we did confirm that the NICU had on a, and I might not get my facts 100% correct, but I believe it was on a Saturday morning, that the NICU did raise issues of concern, that they saw some form of a bug. It was not validated that it was a spider, but it was a critter that you don't want, regardless of what kind it is. That they did notify the house supervisor. The house supervisor called in the company that does our bug control, and the company did respond that day. And I could not verify that the bug actually came in contact with a patient or a patient's family.
Yeah, and I remember the memo you sent, and I'm sorry
I called
you. It basically said it was immediately reported to the supervisor.
Yes, the unit reported it to the house supervisor. The house supervisor called in the contract company, the not even using the right word, the bug control company.
Exterminator.
Thank you.
Okay. And I think there was also comments about that because of the open stairways and
yes,
things like that, that there's, although we are protected against it, that it's not unheard of for a bug of some kind to get into the hospital.
We do have challenges at certain times of years where there's this type of bug that gets attracted to light, and the east tower stairwells are open to the exterior. They have slats so that when you go through the stairwell, you know, it's open. So we do have issues with bug control when we have a certain time of year, and we're coming up on that time of year that tends to be more challenging, because then we put our exterminating company on a higher alert, and those bugs attract to the light. We have to keep the stairwells lit, and that does create...
And unlocked.
And unlocked, because they're emergency exits.
Could I ask?
Yeah.
Could you put maybe, you know, like when you go to a nature preserve and you go into the butterfly cage or the butterfly area, you go through two doors. There's like a screen, so you go through a door and then you go through another door. Would it be profitable to put a screen there maybe that was open, that you could open? But
well, it's if you think of it as the wrap, it's all the way down. So it would actually, I don't think that would work.
But something that,
well, it is as things move forward with the facility and the building and some of the changes that need to be made, it is something that is on the list to address and should be addressed to be able to reconfigure per the codes to be able to change that condition, because it is not an ideal condition to. Okay.
I wanted to point out that you did respond immediately, and although this is the first chance we've had to publicly, your response actually came that day or the next day to Chris,
yeah.
And I wanted to point out that we do get a response to any safety issues or quality issues that are brought up here,
mm-hmm.
or by anybody. Thank you.
Anything else?
Yeah, for old business, last meeting you said you would look into what I called the inaccuracy of the lessee's report, Schedule 1412 of the annual report as required by the lease.
And I believe that was responded to also.
Yeah, but I'll respond to that. So did research that. The annual report that was supplied to us is missing it was misnumbered in a sense, so it is missing the actual 14.9 that Mr. Kaufman has referenced. In researching that though, there is a page in there that does have the capital projects that are associated with that report. I have requested that the report be amended so that it properly states for the record.
Any time frame of when we're going to get done?
Oh, probably within 2 weeks. 1412, can you help me understand what because this has a numbering error, I just want to make sure.
Could Chris has the information because
okay.
he looked it up.
Yeah.
It was just misnumbered. So.
I don't want to misstate, because when we do the annual certification, we don't certify every single lease provision. It calls out which provisions we have to certify.
Right.
So I'll
correct.
Coordinate with you, because I'm not familiar with 1412. is what the provisions.
1412 is the name of the entire schedule. 1412 section of the lease calls for an annual report. They call that annual report Schedule 1412. And in Schedule 1412, it refers back to all of the paragraphs in the lease that require some level of certification. And the paragraph in the lease, 14.9, would certify that the hospital had completed all of the required capital improvement projects. And what I'm really trying to find out is, who approved those capital improvement projects?
The board, I mean, we provided documentation that satisfies that.
No. You provided documentation that in a dollar amount, the requirement had been satisfied. But I have yet to see documentation of who approved or chose the particular capital improvements.
I think there's been documentation that shows that the board of directors at the time approved and acknowledged that the capital projects had been satisfied.
Yes, in dollar amount. Who approved and chose those particular capital projects?
Since I've been on the board, we approved the expansion of the emergency room. That was in the minutes.
Any capital project above a certain amount has to be approved by the board of directors.
And of this board.
The district board has to approve capital projects above a certain amount.
I'm not really interested in who does it now. I'm interested in who did it then. It's a question of whether you granted legislative authority to the lessee.
Will you put your question in writing to Chris, and Chris will take care of giving you an answer. I don't know the answer.
And I will clarify that when I amend this to correct the numbering, it's we're doing the certification period, and the certification period is the last year. So I'm not going back 20 years in this particular.
I understand that.
Okay. Anything else? New business. We have patient safety and quality initiatives. This is why Christine is here. Is Christine here on?
So for our topic today, what I decided to focus on is our patient and safety initiatives, patient safety and quality initiatives for 2018. Just to give you kind of, I know this is hard to see on the TVs, but you guys can you see?
We can give you copies if you want them.
Before you start, is there any reason why you don't submit this in a manner that could be looked at by anybody else before you make the presentation?
To be honest with you, because I usually finish it at the last minute. To be perfectly honest with you. This presentation, I have no problem with it being publicly presented.
There are some items that we can release to the public, and then there are some items that we don't release to the public.
So are there any items that you have here that you can't release to the public? In other words, you're going to show them to us, but you can't have them printed and incorporated into the minutes?
Can Chris move our presentation, please?
Sure.
So some of the initiatives that are focused on, not just with the desert, but are also a focus within all of the tenant facilities, especially in the Desert Care Network, revolve around three main categories: our balanced scorecard metrics, patient safety, and then regulatory. Within the balanced scorecard metrics, I've spoken to this group before about our work with CODI and CLABSI reduction and other infection-related or metrics that we focus on, and the work that we're doing with that, and our infection rates have come down pretty substantially over the past year. Another area is hospital readmissions, and we are meeting the national average for our readmission rates, so that goes and says a lot to the quality of care that we have available to us after the patient's discharge, working with home health, skilled nursing facilities. We've done a lot of work with surrounding nursing homes and things to try and really provide that continuity of care from admission all the way to post-hospital discharge, and then also mortality rates. And we've been working on those specifically in the areas of congestive heart failure, pneumonia, stroke, cardiac-related events, and those also have come down substantially. On the far right is our regulatory accreditation goals that we've been working on, and that has to do with being continually ready for any survey. We actually have Joint Commission over today doing our mid-cycle survey, and it's a mid-cycle survey, so it's a consultative survey. You can submit in writing how you're doing with your the different initiatives for Joint Commission, or you can have them come on site and provide consultation, and we ask them to come on site and work with us on our constant observers and some of our infection rates. And I'm this talk is actually going to focus on is the constant observers. In the middle, we had four main patient safety initiatives this year. Care of the OB patient with early warning system, and we initiated our OB hospitalist program so that there's 24/7 coverage in our OB for triage now. And then the other two works have to do with the operating room, care to prevent routine surgical items, and also universal protocol. And we are working with Dr. Verna Gibbs, a nationally renowned surgeon that has some special work on this. And we are part of the pilot project with Tenet, working on whiteboards and care in the OR and standardizing the process to make sure that the operations are safe. And so that project's going really well. But the one I wanted to really focus on today was the care of the behavioral health patient. And there's a new Senate bill that impacts our homeless population. And this is a really big challenge for us at Desert and in our area. And I wanted to make sure that the district was aware of it, as well as our guests that are here, of some of the challenges that we face. So that's what we'll be focusing on today. And my ICU nurses here know
the challenges
with this patient population as well.
Can I just interject something here? Because I think it's important to put this in context. This was reported to the governing board, and it's based upon the things that have been reported, whether it be California Public Health Department, JCHO, CMS, LeapFrog, that have pointed out areas where we need to have improvement. And so the governing board has decided that these are areas that we need to focus our quality efforts, and what Christine is describing are the details of that.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Right.
Just wanted to
thank you.
Context.
So with our behavioral health patients, we have to institute somebody that can be that constant observer. So a constant observer basically is somebody that's specifically trained to provide a line of sight or a one-to-one care of that patient, to watch that they're not going to be hurting themselves or hurting others when they're in the building. And that's constantly been a challenge for us because of the numbers of patients that we have coming through that require a constant observer, and the number of trained individuals to provide that care, and then just the building space and where we can put them and care for them safely. So we're going to talk a little bit about that and some of the action items that we put into place this year and just the volume of patients that we've had. Why is it important? Well, obviously, going back to Joint Commission and CMS, if there's a suicide or an elopement within a facility when somebody is presented for a behavioral health condition, that obviously is a violation of the statutes, Title 22, and also a Joint Commission regs. So they want to make sure that we have proper protections in place, not only for the patient, but for our staff. So any patient that's receiving round-the-clock care has to understand what patients are at risk for this, and that we're providing safe care for them and documenting carefully. So just to give you an idea about the volume of patients coming through our hospital that are 5150s, meaning they're brought in by law enforcement as a danger to themselves or to others, or they are deemed that by social services when they come on. If you look between 2016 and 2017, just with three quarters of 2018, we've almost met what we've had in past prior years. So we're talking about just coming into the ED 5150s, we're talking over 1,500 patients per year.
Wow.
This is actually a problem in all of our hospitals, and the district is working with Eisenhower, JFK, and Desert to address, first of all, the shortage of inpatient beds that are in the valley, and to try to alleviate the problem. It's a big problem everywhere, but it's really increased dramatically here.
It is, and that's why I brought this up to me.
And it's just about the 5150. Where are you putting the 5150 patients?
It depends. If a 5150 patient comes in and they have actually attempted suicide, maybe they've ingested medications, if they need to be medically stabilized, they may go to the ICU. They may go to one of the units. If they just are waiting for, an outpatient bed, then they are in the immediate emergency room in the back hall, or we may use our IR, but they're in outpatient space because they're not officially admitted.
Well, you know, you cannot by law 5150 a patient unless they're in lockdown. You cannot. We used to 5150 the patients in the ICU, and you can't do that legally. They must be in lockdown by law. So, again, where are you putting them? They have to be, if they come in with a diagnosis of 5150, 72-hour hold, they must be in a lockdown. And there are only, as I remember, a few lockdown rooms in the ER. Otherwise, you know, if a 5150 patient gets up and walks out of the ICU, by law, you cannot detain them.
Correct.
I have, and then I found out after many years of dragging these poor people back.
Right.
Yeah, you can't. You can't by law. I mean, you can do it, but it's not.
Once they get admitted into an inpatient bed, then the 5150 drops off, because 5150 basically is detaining them until they can get to a psych hospital.
Right.
And since we're not a psych hospital, the nurses in the ICU will care, for instance, for them during the. But this has came up as one of our action items, obviously, that we've investigated. That what do you do with them if they try to leave at that point, and we can't stop them?
Can't stop them.
Yep, we can't stop them.
Right.
They have the right to leave.
Have a psych floor before 10 and closed it. Anyway, go ahead.
So did Eisenhower, by the way. They closed theirs too.
Yeah. Well, but you know doesn't relate to your timing.
It does, because there are no inpatient psych beds in the Coachella Valley.
Right.
And
we did have a psych ward.
Right.
Because I worked at.
Go ahead, Christy.
So our goal is to have zero attempted suicides and zero elopements. So that is where our measurement is at. So what has Tenet provided for us to help in this effort? Well, we have screening tools, and it's built into an electronic medical record so that when patients come in, if they are there for a behavioral health complaint, we can determine what their risk factors are and determine if a sitter is warranted. We have certain suicide prevention and constant observation checklists that are in place, certain things in the physical environment that have to be done depending on where they are. Even if they aren't in the emergency room space, but they're up on the floor because they needed to be stabilized from a medical condition, we still are obligated to mitigate whatever's going on in the environment, such as removing a shower curtain or things like that. So even though we don't have behavioral health rooms or safe rooms, mm-hmm. You have to mitigate that, and usually mm-hmm. it's by the constant observer.
And give them plastic.
Plastic silverware. We give them paper scrubs, all of those types of things. Mm-hmm. And then the constant observer, we did a lot of work in the last 2 years for roles and responsibilities training, de-escalation training through CPI, which is a national organization that teaches some basic self-defense moves, but also how to de-escalate. And through our root cause analysis of 3 cases that we had recently, we realized that we also need to just really do some more core education with those nursing assistants and the ones that are doing the one-to-one observation, as well as the nursing staff, on how to care for the patient, because the population seems to be growing, as we mentioned.
Who administers the screening?
The RNs.
RN?
The RN does it as part of the assessment when they come in.
And the how? Oh, go ahead.
I just have a concern that's come up recently with not just for the patients.
A little louder, please.
We have concerns, not just for our psychiatric patients for the suicide precautions, but for constant observers, since constant observers is coming up, that we have multiple patients who, of course, high risk for falls, constantly getting out of bed, going through DTs. We seem to feel pressure that when you request a constant observer, and recently it's been that you actually have to call the CNO at a certain time of night to get to the constant observer. This isn't, to me, about patient safety. It's a financial. And yes, it is a business, but I would hope patient safety is first. So if we're observers for a financial reason, that to me is not in good faith.
So the problem is that the nurses request a constant observer, and?
And before it's approved, the house supervisor or CNO reviews the care plan for the patient to make sure that certain interventions are taking place and that the constant observer meets the criteria.
These constant observers that she mentions, yeah, are those for fall risk or getting out of
the
bed?
Safety sitters.
But it's an important part of the constant observer in that role. And I do feel that patients are put at risk because of not it being looked at more as a financial and
so
not
the,
safety.
But the constant observers for the psych, behavioral health, because I think
you're talking
safety sitters, right?
Right, but that's still called a constant observer.
No, it's a safety sitter. It's two different.
In our policy, it's still constant observer when you actually request. It is a constant observer, and it says the nurse in the policy may have that. But if I have to call the CNO of Desert Regional Medical Center to get a constant observer when my patient is getting out of bed, risk of high fall, falling, that to me is wrong.
And not only that, we had a patient who actually came in as an overdose, was eventually extubated, and she said, I didn't succeed, I'm gonna do it again. And we have to wait for a phone call to get an okay so this lady doesn't hang herself, because she's obviously attempted, which is ridiculous.
So there's a delay in care for those patients.
We're talking a sitter.
Yeah.
Which they're called constant observer.
Okay.
Yeah. A sitter.
Okay. Hopefully we can look into that and get back to you.
I'll talk to you more about that.
Okay. Thank you for your observation.
At any one time, how many constant observers are available in DMOS?
We run about 60 FTEs of constant observers between safety sitters and psych.
Per shift?
We're talking probably about 18 a shift.
About 18 a shift, 18, 20. We've gone up to 30. The number I just gave you is a monthly average of full-time equivalents. So it's significant.
Are they licensed, Michelle?
They're usually CNAs.
CNA.
Yes, ma'am.
So, because a lot of times at night we can't do the sitter because there are no sitters or CNAs available. So
that can be.
More than not.
So when we talk about the action plans that we've been working on, and I probably should just go on with the presentation, but one of the reasons that we call is to see if there's other things that we can do before putting a sitter on, because we found that we still have a number of falls that happen even with a sitter in the room. That's why one thing we talked about, training our sitters better. But then two, maybe there's a better place in the hospital for them. Like in the One East, there's 4-bed wards where one sitter can maybe take care for this side of the room and another or the other, or do line of sight or whatever the case may be. So we're trying to find out different ways to be not only efficient with dollars, which obviously is important, but also with resources and still protecting the patient, because unfortunately just having somebody at the bedside doesn't necessarily prevent the fall. So we want to make sure that, are their medications okay? Have we gotten pharmacy involved? Do we need to talk to the physician? What else have you tried? So, but let me go finish through this.
When a nurse feels that they're not getting appropriate resources to do their job, does he or she have a way of escalating it in real time to get a response?
It really does fall under the jurisdiction of the chief nursing officer. She is the escalation.
There's a lot of micromanagement going on, and it's affecting patient safety.
I'm sorry, I don't know what you mean by that.
Needing a phone call and waiting for an okay to have our patients be safe is uncalled for. Why are we doing the screenings for? We've never had to do that. I mean, if we're saying our patients trying to kill themselves and they could continue to say that, or we have a safety, our patients are going to fall.
So you're saying you're calling the supervisor?
No, the interim CNO wants a phone call, and then she'll call, and then she'll say,
so
okay.
You don't even go through the house supervisor?
No, she wants a specific phone call.
How long does this take, by the way?
It can take, you know, until the patient falls.
Well, I mean, just in minutes. In other words, since this is a time-critical decision, how long does it usually take you people to get an answer, whomever you have to speak to?
Can you say that it's inconsistent?
Well, what's the longest that it's ever taken?
A shift. So then you're pulling your resources, your licensed RNs, to go to that patient, so you pull that resource who could be the transport nurse assisting, could be
a break nurse.
You could have to pull any of those nurses, and on the floor they even have less resources.
I see, and these are decisions that the two nurses are making by themselves. Mm-hmm.
What?
Is this just an open dialogue? No, we gotta go back to my
reason. Go back, by all means.
Well, as we said, we will, it's been documented, and we will study it and get back to the committee and the public.
Well, I think as this next slide, we'll talk about some of the things that the nurses are saying have actually been recognized, and we have a task force that's continually needing to work on the issue. So in the first, there was three cases that came up that caused us to want to do a deeper dive into what we're doing and try and improve the process. And this is how it happened in the last couple months. So first was, as they mentioned, getting that constant observer as soon as possible, especially when we have large volumes. Like when we get to the heat of the summer, we have a large homeless population, so it seems like it just really shoots up the amount of people coming in, and they know what to say to get help, to get a bed, to get some shelter, some food, etc., and they all have to be treated equally. And so if we only have 60 FTEs of CNAs, but now we're requiring 22 sitters at various places, then now we've pulled the CNA from the floor. And so
it's always a problem.
It's always a problem with trying to decide where the resources are. When it comes to a suicide attempt, if you're having to call for that, that just doesn't, that doesn't make sense to me. If it was a fall risk, that somewhere there's a disconnect, and
well,
so I'm really concerned.
That's what's confusing me. Yeah.
There
seems to be a big difference The second situation
was sometimes the patients will present and we don't realize necessarily that it's a behavioral health complaint right away, and so maybe their belongings or that patient hasn't been searched or put into the green scrubs or things. So we actually had somebody that came in that had their belongings still with them, that had some medications in them, in their bag. And so we realized it when they wanted to go to the bathroom and they asked for their belongings in the bathroom up on the floor. And we realized, okay, that's not a good thing. It was a near miss. It didn't harm the patient, but we realized, okay, we need to look at that whole process, since in the ED they lock up the belongings, but we don't have cabinets or lockers or things in the other units if the patients are getting moved up there. And then sometimes these patients are with us for a number of days. Sometimes they're ambulatory, meaning they can walk around, and they get very stir crazy in that room. So in this one case, the constant observer took a patient for a walk in the hallway. Well, we don't mitigate in the hallways like we do in the rooms, and somehow the patient was able to get a plastic bag. Again, we confiscated it and nothing ended up happening, but again, it just triggers us to say this is a concern for us that we want to address before we do have something serious happen. So in order to work on this more in depth, we convened a multidisciplinary task force. There's physicians, psych, physical therapy, pharmacy, the CNAs. There was probably about 30 to 35 people in the room that all had from various units on the floor that came, and they brought all their concerns. We also then did a facility-wide risk assessment, which we have to do on an annual basis anyway, where we went around and we just re-looked at everything with a new set of eyes. When my director of quality for the West Coast region came out, she also did another walkthrough for facility-wide risk assessment to give it another set of eyes. and Joint Commission here today, I've asked them to do another walkthrough and give it another set of eyes, because sometimes when we're in it every day, we don't see some solutions or what might be problems. So we have a lot of people looking at this to see what are we missing or what can we do. We did an extensive review of the ED rooms and had to replace some of the little vents and things like that. If you can see, I don't know if that's a speaker or whatever, but it could become a ligature point where you could actually tie something around it and try to strangle yourself. So in the rooms in the ED, we try to make sure that they have everything necessary for litigation risks removed. Yes, exactly.
What is it? Looks like a sprinkler.
That thing up there.
Fire detector.
It's raised DDT less.
What?
DDT, like they used to do, you know, before silent spring, you know, DDT.
But obviously, even even this lighting wouldn't work because it's the ligatures. Re-education for the constant observers. We did nursing staff leader orientation for the managers and how to do the risk assessments, and we put it on an easy link on the DRMNC page. And we're looking at transitions of care to determine when patients have to go to x-ray or when they're getting moved from one unit to the other. Do we have standard reporting so that they're aware of what's going on? And then we also, the task force did some really great work and developed these written standards for patients and families. This is going to be a trifold. And our sister facilities really loved the work that they did and are going to actually use it at some of the other tenant facilities. But basically what we did is we created this document that's a trifold, and it's given to all of the patients and to the visitors of our 5150 patients so that they know what to expect. They know that if they're going in to visit a patient that's in the emergency room that's under a 5150 watch, that they will need to leave their belongings outside of the room. And it just explains so that everyone is on the same page, and we also developed this guide tool for the inpatient side as well, and we're hoping to have this in distribution for all of you to use within the next month or so. We sent it to our actual marketing department to make it look nice, and we sent it to legal to make sure that we were not violating any patient rights and everything. So the next steps to get it translated now that legal has done that, so that's also in Spanish. And this is going to be a tool that whether you are in the ED or the ICU or, you know, Five Sinatra, we are all telling the visitors and the families and the patients that are here for behavioral health things the exact same things, holding them to the same standards. This whole task force agreed on this and wrote this up themselves. Real big kudos to like Chris Cheatham in the ED did a lot of work on this. Brandon and Five Sinatra did a lot of work on this.
So, do you still have a code? What is it, 11? That brings all
code gray
for all men to hit to come.
It's
to
code gray.
Take someone down. Yeah.
That's very sexist.
It's not all men.
It's not all men, but
I'll see you later, sexless. Okay.
Don't say all strong persons.
All strong persons. All
trained persons.
trained strong.
Because you can make the situation much worse if you don't have the right people responding,
right.
And de-escalating.
They just used it often when I worked. And.
So what we've been trying to do over the past week since the task force is we have break nurses that have been on. We've been trying to assign break CNAs also so that their RNs are not being pulled from, you know, duty to have to watch some of these patients. So that seems to have been helping building the float pool with more CNAs so that there's, you know, it can flex up and down better, adding more per diem positions so that, you know, again, we have that ability to call people in when necessary. Social services and legal consulted with us regarding our 5150 laws and the elopement process. We've changed in Cerner how the ordering is done for constant observers. It's triggering the doctors to renew it every 24 hours for our psych now. We've also done extensive discussions in our A-team meetings with medical staff, reviewing options for telepsych. Poor Dr. Levinson is stretched extremely thin. He's one of our main psychiatrists that comes in with the volume of patients that we're having. So out recruiting for additional psychiatrists and things for this area is very key. Auditing
and difficult because
yes.
There is a shortage.
Yeah, we were ready to sign an agreement with a company called Access Physicians to provide telepsych. And just as we were really getting ready to sign the actual agreement, we started having some dialogue and an outreach from UCR, where they were requesting that maybe if we worked with their fellowship psych programs, that may be a better alternative for the community, because they felt that they could provide better continuity of care post-hospital discharge. And so we kind of held on doing the telepsych component until we could see if we could make that work with UCR. Because I do think that having doctors that are more local here and that would be willing to do post-discharge visits in their offices and in the UCR primary care clinics and some of the other locations that they could be set up would better serve the community. So we're in those discussions right now.
And as Dr. Zindel mentioned, we are involving the community in the need for inpatient beds in the area, and hopefully we will have some inpatient beds, you know, in the near future opening up.
Acadia's
in Indio area. Yeah,
they are looking to find an alternative site than the site that they selected that wasn't well embraced by the community that they were located. So they're going to try to find a site that's not quite so close to some neighborhoods.
So next steps, we're continuing to dialogue with the community regarding the available beds. We're continuing to assess the physical building to locate areas where maybe we can do some construction to better, more safely house the volume in the ED as we're waiting for beds, because especially the pediatric behavioral health, sometimes they're there for days, weeks. We had one child that was there for almost 3 weeks, and it wasn't
good.
It's just not good. We just don't have beds anywhere for them. And then I did bring, anybody wants it, this is a summary of SB 1152. It's a new Senate bill that is regarding the care of homeless patients. It requires that anyone coming into a hospital that is homeless, that we cannot discharge them without having available resources for them. And we are going to be collaborating with other Inland Empire hospitals to determine the best way to address this. So it's a collaborative with hospitals throughout San Bernardino County and Riverside County to try and determine the best way to work on this. And we have to have this in place by January 1st. So.
Is this one of the ideas to use the North Palm Springs Firehouse?
That was an idea prior to this, and now we are. Now we're under the gun to actually have to do something quickly. So
that won't happen in the timeline before this is implemented. Many of the components that are required, you know, we already provide, but there are some components that we're trying to get some definition, because you know how laws are written, they don't necessarily give you the nuances of the various situations that you could. That you can run into. I know we have several people that are be participating in a WebEx for the California Hospital Association or United Hospital Association. We'll be doing a WebEx on some of the strategies for compliance. I think on this list, the one that concerns me the most is probably transportation, because mm-hmm. there is written in here some accommodation on transportation within a certain mile radius. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't only apply to inpatients, it also applies to ED patients.
What's that?
ED. ED, yeah, mm-hmm. to ED patients.
And Lyft and Uber wouldn't work?
Well, it might, but that's part of what we have to sort through with some of the industry guidance and legal is, okay, how do we define this? And how do we
And to exacerbate this, the Ninth Court of Appeals just came out with a ruling that municipalities cannot keep people from camping. Linda, help me.
You can't arrest people for being homeless if
right.
there's not an alternative shelter available. So you can't, law enforcement can't just do something and take action against somebody on the streets. If they haven't exhausted all resources for that individual, yeah.
So if they're camping out somewhere in public, you can't make them move
unless they're committing some type of crime.
Right.
Right.
So that's exacerbating the whole issue. Okay, keep going.
So that was just the overview of some of the challenges and just reassuring.
Capital C.
You know, our staff, it's an ongoing task force. I've looked up more feedback from from those of you. There are some representatives from ICU, but you can talk to me after. We'll involve you, but it's a definite work in progress. And
appreciate that. I appreciate the comments as well. Any other comments?
I have one question. The chief nursing officer seems to have a significantly important role here. Is there a protocol that she looks at with regard to whether to assign? Yes. You think we could get a copy of that?
Well, you guys probably have a copy of it.
Obviously, there's a vote.
Because we should be able to get a constant observer, and no matter what we say, it's what she said.
Well, there's well, that's
the doctor ordered.
That's the question I was trying to ask you guys.
So I think,
have you ever been told no, or are you just feeling a delay?
We haven't told no.
You haven't told no?
Prior to, right after that, somebody has fallen.
Yeah. And you put in an ESRM?
Absolutely. Okay. And one where the patient said, I tried to kill myself, I put an ESRM. Sorry. I've never gotten any responses about it.
Is that one of these root cause ESRMs?
And we've had meetings with her, and she has literally walked out of the meeting. We've asked for responses. We're still waiting. And it's been over 10
minutes. That was the CNA meeting?
That was a meeting.
What was that?
An ICU meeting regarding our immune service.
We have to make a check. Title 22 says it is up to the nurse, the RN, to determine the acuity and what you need. It's not up to the CNO. It is up. Title 22 specifically says it is up to the RN at the bedside will determine the care needed for the patient because they are at that bedside. It is not the CNO. It is not tenant. It is not your grandfather. It's you. And the, you know what, the contract...
She's been breaking the law, you're right, and that's what we've been telling her.
The words are, the law is in your contract. There are words on a page unless you execute them.
We have multiple grievances in regards to it, and nothing's been addressed.
Oh, I'm so surprised. Well, thank you for bringing it here, and it will be addressed.
And that's why we're here.
Good. Thank you.
It was canceled the last time, so we would have been here faster.
Good.
And we do this on our own time because we care about our community.
Yeah, sure. Thank you very much.
I have one other question for the two directors.
Can I just say something first?
Go ahead.
No.
Thank you. Mitch, I would like to see this issue discussed at the governing board since it kind of straddles the operational versus quality thing, and I agree it's an issue. It has both operational and quality impact, but I really do hope that we can talk about this at the governing board in some way, and we'll talk about that later. And I think it's our responsibility as district representatives on the governing board to report back to the district that the governing board has addressed this.
Okay, sure.
Great.
At those meetings, do you talk about this with the chief nursing officer?
Yes.
At the governing board meetings?
When there is an issue that's brought up, we often ask the chief nursing officer
who is the CNO?
If I can
interject, we have an interim CNO right now. She completes the assignment, I want to say, next Thursday. And then we have our new chief nursing officer, Scott Morey, who's joining us on November 5th, would be his first day. So, I mean, clearly this will be a priority area for when he onboards on November 5th. But I do think we need to engage him in what the long-term solution, short and long-term solution is. Yeah.
And I do remember when Beverly was CNO, when there were quality issues involving nurses, we did discuss it at the governing board. It has been less so with the interim, but I understand the new CNO is excellent.
And at the risk, I think that some of what I have heard is a certain thought process that in a critical care unit, you shouldn't need fall sitters because of your, you know, your line of sight and your ratios. But that may not be consistent with what Beverly believed, and it may not be consistent.
I understand.
With what Scott.
We're talking about our ratios being lower, so we're supposed to be super humans to be able to take care of these high PD patients.
I'm
anyway, we will discuss it.
I agree with the board, disagree, I'm just sharing it. And I would like Scott to be the one who really engages, because Scott is making us the long-term commitment. He is relocating his family, and his commitment to me is to be in, because I consider one of the issues that we've had is that we've had changes in the CNO position a lot. I mean, it's like every couple of years it's a new CNO, and that's very difficult on a nursing organization to have different leaders with sometimes different thoughts, philosophies, and experiences. So Scott's commitment to me is he's considering this to be his last destination, where he's wanted to be in his career for the last 10 years, is here in the desert, at Desert. And so his commitment is he's going to finish out his last 7 to 10 years at Desert Regional Medical Center. And in my viewpoint, that is what the facility needs. As an individual who's very committed, wants to live in this community, wants to stay in this community, wants to be part of the community, and is going to be with Desert for the long haul.
Michelle, can I just say something real quickly? You know, we did have, back in the day, because I talked to you, said the Marquettes, the monitors, well, they were very complicated, and actually a nurse could be in one room and actually pull out the other room.
Yeah, the split screens?
Sort of, yeah, it's a long time ago, but they're very complicated. They were great once you got it, but anyway, they were out when the HPs came in, I guess, the Hewlett Packards, right? So anyway, but, you know, you can be in one room, and the way this is set up, unlike Eisenhower, which is just the curtains, I guess, you know, this is separate pods, separate rooms, and when you're doing care and the curtain is closed and the door is closed, and you have a patient in another room going crazy, you're getting out of bed, there is no line of sight. And if there's no monitor at the desk, I mean monitor tech, that tech views the whole circle. And it's not pretty. I mean, I had a patient and I had to have every available security and monitor tech in the room to hold this guy down as he came out of anesthesia post-open heart. He's a drug addict. And so, you know, we can't restrain anybody anymore. So I had them call the doctor. I mean, would you like to come in and hold the patient down? It's either that or medical restraint. I mean, you cannot. So my other patient was in need. It's not line of sight in the ICU, you know that. And you can't hear when the door is shut. It's very dangerous. I mean, you can be with a dressing change on a burn patient for 3 or 4 hours, actually. I mean, we had a 7-hour dressing change with Dr. Erkley on a trauma patient. We did it in shifts. I mean, this is, we need help in the ICU.
Thank you, Stephanie. Thank you for that observation. Yeah. That's helpful. Anything else?
Next item.
Let's move on to other new business, hospital safety and compliance inspections. Chris, do you want to give us an overview?
Sure. There was some discussion previously about, and it's been part of our requirements or the parameters that we set up for this committee, the Hospital Governance and Oversight Committee, to implement an inspection process, a quarterly type of process. The district would work with the Desert Regional staff to develop an inspection plan and process. So what we've included in the packet today is a copy of a plan that has been utilized for quite some time at Grossmont Hospital, which is also a district-owned hospital. And so it's an example of something that we would like to implement and work with Desert Regional staff to develop a plan specific for this hospital. The intent would be to engage with an independent like engineer or someone that may be, you know, familiar with the hospital, like former facilities maintenance person to help with those inspections.
Can you clarify for me, is this, we have the big one, is this sort of to make that an ongoing periodic review? In other words, a follow-up
so
from the one we did last year?
The one we did last year.
Which was the whole hospital.
But it was more seismic. Really?
No, no, not the seismic. I'm talking about the, we did an inspection of the hospital
What this is designed to do, and I actually kind of like the format of it, is that there's each quarter, the entire hospital is not being inspected. There's sections, or as they've defined, blocks in certain areas.
No, I understand, but is this as a follow-up from what we did last year for the hospital inspections?
No, it's part of what we've defined, the requirements that and parameters that we've defined for this committee is okay. To do quarterly inspections. So okay. It would be supplemental.
Can you connect it in my mind? I need to connect it in my mind to what we did last year.
Okay, so it would be from what was done last year, we would be implementing dovetail off of that.
An ongoing
to
periodic.
Yes,
right.
Okay. Would be,
so it is related to what we did last year.
So it
last year was your baseline.
Right. And
it was a baseline.
And we're taking something that was not done before last year to make it an ongoing thing into the future.
Correct.
Okay, that's what I wanted to clarify.
Okay, yes. So, and it would be, the thought would be to set it up as like a two-year schedule or whatever is defined and so that it just cycles through. And there are quarterly reports then that would be brought to the committee.
Brought to this committee, and then significant things would be reported to the board of directors.
Correct. So that would be the recommendation to the committee.
And I think the discussion we've had is that we would work in collaboration with Desert Regional staff to devise a schedule and reporting process.
Correct.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a good idea. I think it's an acknowledgement that we should have been doing this before last year, and we weren't. The district wasn't. And it is a district responsibility to do it. And we started last year, but now we're not just doing one-time inspections. Mm-hmm. We're going to have a continuous review of the entire facility and blocks that will be updated. I think it's a good idea. And I hope, and I'm sure DRMC will work with us to come up with a schedule. And when we do that, we'll bring it to this committee to approve that. And what kind of, obviously we'll have to go to the board for any financial, it's gonna cost something to do this.
Correct.
And do we estimate how much something like that might cost?
I have no idea at this point. It depends on who we enlist, if it's, you know, my thought would be to reach out to, I believe his name is Dale Barnhart, who was the former facilities person there.
How much was the inspection last year? How much did that cost about?
Who's on the team for the Grossmont? Because this looks pretty visual to me.
Let's work out those details. Right. I do think that...
if you look at the minutes, you can see who's participating.
Anyway, I would like to, obviously, we need to bring back how much this is going to cost.
Correct, yes. Yeah. So this is getting direction from the committee to move forward on this.
Yeah, and yes, we bring it back here and to the board for funding.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't see where it's saying who participates.
It's page 20.
Yeah, but are those engineers or are those staff members?
Well, that's why I was kind of...
Well, if you're talking about the minutes.
So Mr. Jantz is the CEO of the inspection party.
I think he's CEO of the hospital.
Director of Engineering, Project Manager.
Oh, maybe CEO of the district.
District.
Right.
Okay, yeah. And then George Cavaz is the district facilities consultant, and then the people below that are Grossmont Hospital representatives.
Right.
Did you find that?
Facilities consultant. Well, it says the facilities consultant, George Cavaz.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But it doesn't say what organization.
Well, I suggest we take this to the board of directors of the district for approval.
Yeah, I would like to have the staff actually work up a proposal.
I think you have a policy.
No, we have the policy.
Okay, that already says you really can come over and inspect anytime.
Right, but I'd like this. I would like us to direct the staff to come up with a proposal that
that has all the details in it, including the cost, that...
Before we take it to the board, have all of that mm-hmm. in place.
Yes, before we take it to
the board. Yeah, before we take it to the board. Right. And I don't necessarily think it needs to... Well, how long do you think it would take to come up with that policy or that document?
We'll need to coordinate some time together to devise.
I mean, it wouldn't be difficult. It looks pretty, like what they've done is they've gone floors, towers, mm-hmm. and some of the ancillary areas, and they just basically have blocked out the whole entire building and rotated, so that would be,
so
the
schedule would be high. Do you think by our next oversight committee meeting, you could have something here to then go to the board in November, or do you think that's too quick?
I would like to shoot more for December. If we are able to have for November, then okay. I think we're ahead of the game.
But certainly by the end of the year.
Correct.
Before the end of the year. Okay.
Is that feasible?
Start at the first of the next year. That's fine. Because really your only expense will be the consultant that you choose to bring in for your facility side.
Correct.
Right. And the entire hospital was inspected last year.
So, yeah.
Yeah, good.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you all for coming, and thank you for your time and all your suggestions.
When is the next meeting?